RadioInfluence.com. This is Beyond the Badge on Radio Influence. A look inside the biggest and most controversial news stories you need to know now. One of the country's most relied upon law enforcement analysts, Vincent Hill.
Good evening and welcome to Beyond the Badge. I'm your host, Vincent Hill, coming to you, of course, from Atlanta, Georgia, as I do each and every Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on RadioInfluence.com and available for download on iTunes.com. But don't worry, if you're not part of the Apple generation, you can go over to Stitcher Radio, look for the show there, download it. There's no reason you should not hear this show. If you are an American citizen who is concerned with the state of police, the state of community, you should be listening to this show. Now, with that said, I want to follow up on something I mentioned last week where I was excited because I was the new contributor to Bold Global. And actually, last Wednesday, the day after I went off the air last week, Bold published my very first article. You can find it at Bold Global under the Voices section, and it's entitled, Democrats, Police Reform and Race, Can Candidates Live Up to the Campaign Promises? And in the article, I talk about how the Democratic presidential candidates have gotten behind such movements as the Black Lives Matter movement, pushing for police reform, and I go into what I've gone into before. Is this something the Democrats truly have at heart, that they want to see this, or is it because, as history has shown, the Democratic Party needs the black vote in order to get elected? So in the article, I touch on those issues. Please go read it, bold.global. Go to the Voices section. Please leave your comments after you've read the article. I promise you it will probably open a little eyes and be very enlightening. But don't take my word for it. Please go read it for yourself. Leave your comments and let me know what you think. If you don't leave your comments there, of course, you can tweet me, Vincent Hill Sr., VincentHillSr. Tweet me, let me know your thoughts. Also, follow me on Twitter. As they say, I follow back. So follow me on Twitter, read the article, let me know what you think about that. Now, some of you that are my age, 40-something, can remember way back in 1994 and the whole O.J. Simpson case and the murder trial where he was charged with the murder of his wife and friend Ron Goldman. Now, last week, the LAPD came out and said that they've had a knife that was recovered by some construction guy way back in like 1998 when the house that O.J. was living in was being torn down. He supposedly found this knife, turned it over to an off-duty police officer who, for whatever reason, never turned it in as evidence. And, you know, here it is 20-plus years later. This officer's about to retire, and somehow the knife was mentioned, and I think the retiring police officer had called one of his buddies and said, hey, I need the case number so I can engrave it on the frame that I'm going to put this knife in. So allegedly, supposedly, the LAPD is testing the knife for DNA, blood evidence, and all this other good stuff. But here's the thing, and I am a firm believer that O.J. Simpson was responsible for the deaths of Nicole and Ron Goldman. But there are several issues with this whole knife thing. The first being double jeopardy, which means O.J. cannot be tried for the same crime twice. So he got away with murder back in 1994 or 95, whenever the trial was over. So here we are 20 years later, 21 years later. This guy says, oh, the knife was here. It had blood on it. Let's test it for DNA. So even if the knife has Nicole Brown's blood on it, or Ron Goldman's blood on it, or OJ's blood on it, OJ is going to sit there and still know that he got away with murder because he can't be tried for it. The only thing recovering DNA from that knife would prove, would solve, was either did OJ do it, or did he not do it? But here is another problem. So this worker found this knife buried somewhere on O.J. Simpson's property. Now, if you think back to that trial, one of the biggest things the defense put in everyone's head is that the LAPD planted evidence. So let's take double jeopardy out of the equation for just a second, and let's think about this. If the whole premise of that case was based on race and planted evidence, any half-wit defense attorney would come back and say, well, wait a minute, you searched my client's house the night of the murders. You searched his property because you found the glove outside. Why did you not see fresh digging? Why in the days after the murder did you not see fresh digging where he would have buried the knife? And also, why would my client be crazy enough to bury the knife but leave behind a glove? Oh, I know why, Mr. LAPD racist officer, because you planted the glove there and there was no knife at the scene. And this whole thing is a hoax. This is what the defense would say, because that's what any defense would say, and rightfully so, because here we are 20 plus years later, and this guy, this officer of the law who supposedly had this knife, decided to keep it. So now this officer, his attorney is saying in his statement that the officer did indeed try to turn the knife in way back in 2002 or whenever he came into contact with it, but when he called the station, he was told by supervisors that since O.J. Simpson was acquitted of the murders, they don't want to have anything to do with the knife. So he decided to keep it. Now, is that story true? I don't know. I'm not that officer. I'm not those supervisors. But if it is true, it kind of brings bad light back on the LAPD, because there's going to be a lot of people that said, hey, yeah, we understand there's double jeopardy. We understand all this, but 15 plus years ago, you could have at least told us whether based on DNA that, yes, the murder weapon was recovered from the suspect's house, or no, this is not the murder weapon. So it's going to shed bad light on the LAPD if this officer's claim is true that he attempted to turn the knife in, but he was told since OJ was acquitted, they don't want to have anything to do with it. That doesn't look good. Just like the entire case didn't look good. Because let's be honest, OJ didn't get off because of reasonable doubt. There was no reasonable doubt. The evidence always pointed to OJ Simpson, no other suspect. His blood was mixed with the victim's blood. The victim's blood was in his vehicle, at his property. Their blood was on his socks that were recovered from his bedroom. There was no other suspect. But at least, if this would have been discovered whenever that knife was discovered, to say, yes, this was the murder weapon, because we know conclusively that Nicole Brown Simpson's blood is on here, that Ron Goldman's blood is on here, that would have shut the case officially. So now OJ, who is in prison for unrelated charges, actually laughed when he heard that they had found this knife on their property. And his quote, this is his words, not mine, is complete bullshit. This is what OJ said. But here's a guy that in his civil trial deposition lied about everything. So him saying it's BS doesn't really convince me that he didn't know anything about it. It's just simply when he laughed and said it's bullshit, it's because he knew that even if it is, you guys can't touch me. I'm free. Well, free of that crime. He's probably going to die in prison based on his age and based on the time he has for the robbery in Vegas. But, you know, something that was the crime of the century, the trial of the century, and something that could have been evidence of that crime just sat in someone's house for 20 years. That's mind-blowing to me. Mind-blowing. But enough about OJ. It's done. The case will never be reopened, in my opinion, unless on this knife there's DNA that comes back to someone other than O.J. Simpson, and it has Nicole Simpson's blood and it has Ron Goldman's blood, then the case may be reopened. But again, in my opinion, I know who did that crime. So let's get into Beyond the Badge. This is our meat and potatoes of the show. And what I want to talk about tonight is the rise in crime in 2015 and what I believe it's based on. And what it's based on is not that there's more criminal element running the streets, running wild, and it's just the wild, wild west and every man for themselves. And it's definitely not because there's less officers on the street, because let's be honest, police academies graduate people every day across this country who, those graduates, are tasked with protecting and serving the community. So it's not that there's more criminals. It's definitely not that there's less police. What the problem is, especially a lot of the guys that have been on for a while, when I say guys, I include girls in that as well, a lot of the officers that have been on for a while that know what's going on in the street are not being proactive. Proactive policing, contrary to what a lot of groups will tell you, not only deters crime, but it prevents crime. And in this society that we're in of the Black Lives Matter movement, and everyone has a cell phone video, and everyone knows what excessive force is, police are not being as proactive as they would like to be. So let's look at some numbers of crime stats in 2015. And these numbers are quite staggering and troubling, to say the least. Let's look at Baltimore. Baltimore, since the death of Freddie Gray, witnessed a 63% in homicides. 63%. Now remember, Freddie Gray, the suspect who was running from police, who was a known drug dealer, who was a known vandalizer, who happened to die in the back of a police van. He died. They tried the officers for the crime. Well, they charged the officers for the crime, and the first case was a mistrial. 63% spike in homicides. Now let's look at Chicago. Now we already know Chicago is crazy. Chicago's through the roof already with murders. I mean, last July 4th, there were 40-something people that were shot, and a lot of those people died in Chicago. So since the shooting death by police of Laquan McDonald, who, again, police contact, police had a reason to be there. He was walking down the street with a knife, vandalizing property. A knife is a deadly weapon. Since his shooting death and the shooting death of Cedric Chapman, who carjacked a suspect, carjacked a victim, who assaulted the victim, who ran from police, who had an item in his hand, when police thought, based on what they were responding to, a carjacking and an assault, that it could be a weapon, and he was a fleeing felon, he was shot. Since those two shooting deaths in Chicago, the murder rate in Chicago increased 14%. Now that is crazy to me, considering how high Chicago's murder rate already is. 14% in Chicago from 2014 to 2015? Can you imagine that? Now, I love the city of Chicago. I graduated high school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I used to go to Chicago all the time. But I don't think I'll be visiting Chicago anytime soon. That 14% murder increase from one of the highest cities already in the nation for murders, that to me is ridiculous. And again, it's not because there's less police on the street. It is not because there's more criminals. It's because police are not doing proactive policing. Police officers in Baltimore have gone on record and said they are no longer doing proactive policing. They're only doing reactive. Now, before we touch on reactive, let's define what proactive policing is. Now, having experience in this line of work, I can tell you what proactive policing is. Proactive policing, quite simply, is this. It is police legal contact with individuals through a legal means. Now, that legal means could be an expired registration. It could be a busted taillight. It could be, hey, you fit the description of someone that just ran from this store. There's a lot of things that can be considered a legal reason for police to make contact with someone. So when you're talking about proactive policing, one of the most common forms is a traffic stop. Now, given today's society, given the way police view or society views police now, most people see traffic stops as nothing more than harassing and profiling. Oh, why'd you stop me? Don't you have anything else better to do? Don't you need to go catch real criminals? Well, here's the thing. Out of the countless drugs that I've seized and the guns that I've seized, 90% of those came from a traffic stop, which generated from a busted taillight or an expired registration. So real criminals are being arrested based on traffic stops, which is a very common form of proactive policing. When I caught a murder suspect in Nashville who was wanted in Atlanta for murder and cocaine charges, who fit the description of someone who had just committed a crime, I easily could have said, nah, I'm just going to let that go. But I was proactive and I approached him and I knew he was lying to me. And when I took him to jail and his fingerprints came back that he was wanted in Atlanta, that was a form of proactive policing. It wasn't harassing. I had a legal reason to make contact with this individual, which gave me a right to go and talk to him. And it came out that he was wanted for murder and cocaine charges in Atlanta, Georgia, and he was hiding out in Nashville, Tennessee, and he had been for years. That's proactive policing. That's how criminals get caught, crime gets deterred, crime gets prevented. Proactive policing. Now let's look at a few examples of what it is to be reactive in police work. And you never want an officer to be reactive because, of course, when you're reactive, you're reacting to something. So, a very good example of reactive policing, and I've brought this case up before, but it just sticks out in my mind, is Tamir Rice. Now, the 12-year-old who was shot in Cleveland, who had the toy gun. So, police, based on what they were given by the dispatcher, were reacting to a male with a gun. And when Tamir reached in his waistband for what the officer believed was a gun, he acted accordingly, based on his training, based on his God-given right to protect himself, based on muscle memory, based on a whole bunch of stuff. He reacted the way he should have. He believed that young Tamir had a gun. He believed young Tamir was pulling for that gun. He responded accordingly. Based on the use of force continuum, based on training, he did what he was supposed to do. That is reactive policing. Now, let's look at it from a proactive way. Let's say those officers didn't get that call, and they just happened to be by the park where Tamir was, and they saw Tamir, and, hey, Mr. Tamir, how are you? I'm Officer Joe Blow. Why don't you come over here and talk to me? Oh, what is this? Oh, I'm sorry, officer, it's a toy gun, and I'm just out here holding it. I know I shouldn't be. You're right, Mr. Tamir. I'm Officer Joe Blow, and I'm going to make sure that this is a toy gun, and then I'm going to instruct you how to get it home without you being shot. That would have been proactive policing, but the officers were not given that chance to do that. They were only given the chance to react to what they were told. Gun, suspect. Nothing to do with age, nothing to do with color, just gun and suspect. So what happens when we live in a world where officers are in fear of doing their job because they think they're going to be ridiculed for being a racist or caught on camera using what someone says is excessive force? The whole world just becomes the Wild Wild West, where there's no law and order. And unfortunately, this is the way that our society is going. If we saw increases in 2015 for murder rates in cities that already had high murder rates, we have a problem. We have a problem when police don't want to use force, even to protect their lives, because they don't want to be seen as the white officer who had to use force on a black suspect because there's five people recording it on their cell phone video. And if you don't believe me, just be reminded of the detective in Birmingham, Alabama, the white detective, who did get pistol whipped by his own pistol by a black suspect because he feared that if he used force, he was going to be the next officer on CNN. And that is sad that this man would rather put his life in danger, because when you're being pistol whipped, let's be honest, when you're taking blows to the head, it can kill you at any given second. He would rather do that and have his family suffer than to use force because he doesn't want to be that guy in the news. He doesn't want to be that guy explaining why he had to shoot, quote unquote, an unarmed black male, even though he would have been justified in using deadly force. What kind of society are we living in? It's sad. It's troubling. It's frightening. If it doesn't frighten you, it should. And here's the sad part. In this current society that we're in, and all these movements and protests and all these activists, anything other than, sir, please place your hands behind your back, is considered excessive force. If an officer has to touch someone, it's considered excessive force. And then you have all these street lawyers that know what they're talking about when it comes to how you should be able to treat a suspect. Oh, he's unarmed, so you shouldn't have to take him down like that. Oh, I'm sorry, I guess you've missed the part where he's sitting here struggling and fighting with the officer. Oh, I guess you missed down in Casey, South Carolina, when the two officers tried to arrest the guy and he was struggling and fighting, and guess what he came out of his pocket with? A gun. And guess what? He shot one of the officers. And guess what? The suspect is now dead, as he should be, because the officers were met with deadly force and they returned with deadly force. So for all those people who have this failure to communicate, have this failure to understand the use of force, go learn it. Go learn it. Go do a ride along with the local police. Go find out what use of force is. Go down to a roll call. Go find out what use of force is. Go to the police academy. Take a course in the use of force. I bet you, you'll open your minds to what the use of force actually is and what excessive force actually is, more importantly. I don't know about you, but I want my streets back. I have a 14-year-old son who walks the street to go to school, who walks the street to get back from school. Yeah, granted, he takes a bus, but there's a little section where he has to walk to get home. I don't want to have to fear that crime rate is going up so high, and it's even affecting here in Atlanta, because police don't want to do their jobs. I don't want to have to worry about my son being killed or hurt because police didn't want to do their jobs, and the guy who hurt my son, they could have caught, but they didn't want to catch him because they may have to use force and they may be on CNN the next week. I don't know about you, but I don't want that. So what I do want is police to be proactive. You should want police to be proactive. This is how crime is deterred, and it's how crime is prevented. Think about this for 1 second. I've lost count of how many guns I've seized on traffic stops, but I can tell you, some of those people, well, pretty much all of those people that I seized guns from were convicted felons, which by law says you can't even own a gun. Some of those had had previous charges of murder, assault, attempted murder. So what do you think they had the gun for? It wasn't for their own protection, I assure you. It was because they were going to go do damage to someone else. They were going to go kill someone else. So when I seized a gun, did I prevent a crime? Absolutely, I prevented a crime. I prevented a murder, an attempted murder, an ag assault, a robbery, you name it. It was prevented by that simple traffic stop because their tag was expired, or their headlight was out, or their taillight was out. Proactive policing. It solves crimes. It deters crimes. It prevents crime. Here's something a lot of people don't realize, and here's a reality check. Remember when I said proactive policing is police legal contact with individuals through a legal mean? Now, legal contact, of course, means officer presence. Now, let's tie this into the use of force continuum. And a lot of people don't realize that the very first step on the use of force continuum is officer presence. And it's considered the best way to resolve a situation. The mere presence of a law enforcement officer works to deter crime or defuse a situation. So, when we're talking proactive policing and we're talking use of force, the use of force continuum is already tied into the legal contact, the officer presence, the contact with the individual. It's already there. From there, it's up to the person the officer has, whether they choose to escalate the situation by not complying or to comply with the officer. So the only step in the use of force continuum is that officer presence. It is that officer presence through a traffic stop where you may just get a ticket and be on your merry way. Or the use of force can escalate based on that traffic stop because you fail to comply. I don't have to show you my license. I know my rights. Yes, you do have to show me your license because I have stopped this vehicle to investigate a traffic stop. And by law, by Supreme Court, it tells me I can get your identification. And the minute you choose not to give it to me is the minute I think you have something to hide. So, officer presence, proactive policing, use of force, it's all tied together. And a lot of people don't realize it, and that's where people go wrong. We really need to get our heads on straight if we want this country to be what it's supposed to be. Safe, productive, secure. We better get our heads on straight. Those groups that want to condemn police and think that all police are bad, you're messing up this country. I assure you, you probably don't even realize the murder rate has gone up. You probably don't realize the rape rate has gone up because you've been so focused on being divisive and just thinking that this problem is limited and it only affects a certain group of people. No. When the Ferguson effect has caused officers not to want to do their jobs, it doesn't affect just certain people. It affects this entire country because it could be your daughter that gets raped. It could be your son that gets shot and killed. It could be you that gets carjacked. And I bet you'll call for the police then. I bet you won't worry if they use force then. What you need to do is allow police to do their jobs, to be proactive in their communities, which they're sworn to do on a daily basis, which they joined the academy to do way back when, or that they had dreams and aspirations to do when they were just a little kid like I did. I didn't get in the job so I could carry a gun. I can do that anyway. I didn't get in the job so I could get a badge or wear a uniform. I wore a uniform for my entire adult life in the military. I got in that job because as a kid, I wanted to do that. I wanted to protect and serve. I wanted to go out and get drugs off the street. I wanted to go out and get guns off the street. I wanted to be that proactive guy. And my record showed that I was. Officer of the month, countless times. Awards, because I was proactive in my policing. And I stopped crime. We better wake up in this country. We better allow police the opportunity, the leeway to do what they are sworn to do. I got one last stat that's really troubling, and it involves the death of police officers. There has been a 500% increase in the amount of officers killed this year, 2016, by gunfire. We're at 12 already. We're in March. We're at 12. That's a 500% increase. If you don't believe me, just go to the Officer Down Memorial page, odmb.org, and the stat is right there. 500% increase in the deaths of police officers by gunfire. That means bad guys, black, white, Chinese, I don't care what they are. That means bad guys are shooting police because for whatever reason. So not only do we have a spike in crime in this country, not only do we have police not wanting to be proactive, we have people that decide, hey, we can kill police anytime we dang well please, and we've proven it. We've increased the death of police in this country by 500% this year, and we're only in March. That's troubling. When I say we need to wake up in this country, I really mean we need to wake up in this country. Now, with that, it's time for roll call. And for my first-time listeners, roll call is not the traditional roll call that you would think about police officers being in. It's when I talk about the officers that have given the ultimate sacrifice, given their life in the line of duty. And we have, unfortunately, three more names to add to that list from last week. Deputy Sheriff Travis Russell, Los Animas County Sheriff's Office, Colorado. He was killed March 1st, 2016, via an automobile accident. Police Officer David Huffer was shot and killed. There's one of those 500%. March 1st, he was with the Ulysses Police Department in Texas. And Police Officer Scott Fitzgerald, who died March 4th by an automobile accident, he was with South Jacksonville Police Department, Illinois. We have three more officers to add to the list in 2016. Godspeed to you. My prayers to your families, to your friends. Thank you for your service. I thank you for listening. In the upcoming weeks, I'm going to start having a co-host on the show. I really believe you will enjoy her. She and I go way back. She was actually one of my field training officers when I was coming up as a young buck out there in Nashville, Tennessee. We worked East Precinct together. We've kept in touch over the years. I think you will enjoy her once I begin to have her on. We're going to bring you some exciting stuff. We're going to bring you some different stuff. I can't wait for that. I want to thank you for listening. As always, I love you. I appreciate you. Don't forget to check me out, bold.global. My article will be out, I believe, this Wednesday. And it's going to be a weekly thing there at bold.global. Follow me on Twitter, Vincent Hill Sr., VincentSr. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next week.
To continue the conversation, get updates on the show, and to find out when you can see him on television, follow Vincent on Twitter at Vincent Hill Sr. That's Vincent Hill Sr. This has been Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill on Radio Influence.
Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sports scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Kershaw, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.